Football Weekly is on the air.
Hi, I'm Hub Arkish, and along with Eric Edholm and the entire Pro Football Weekly editorial department, it is our great pleasure to bring you this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly, where every week, 52 weeks a year, we're here to talk NFL with you.
We talk about Justin Blackmon and Brandon Weeden, a couple of rookies in the news for different reasons, and Hub breaks down why the players may have gotten a bad deal in the latest CBA last year.
It's all just ahead on Pro Football Weekly.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us again this week for Pro Football Weekly. I am Hub Arkish, the publisher and editor here, along with senior editor Eric Edholm, who will be our co-host in studio this week as we visit with a number of members of the Pro Football Weekly editorial department on our hard line back to the PFW offices. And we're going to start in this first segment with Arthur Arkish, our associate editor who covers the AFC South. And Arthur, one of the biggest stories of the week is the, we'll call it, bad behavior of one Justin Blackmon. Got himself in some serious trouble. The Jaguars held a press conference. Tell us what's going on.
Well, Blackmon, the Jaguars' top pick back in April, as you said, definitely got himself into quite a bit of trouble. He was arrested in the wee hours last Sunday morning back in Stillwater, where he went to college, for aggravated DUI. This is his second arrest for DUI. This one is a little bit more serious. He blew three times the legal limit in the state of Oklahoma. There's a court date scheduled for July 24th. It sounds like the Oklahoma prosecutor are going to prosecute to the fullest extent of the law with Blackmon. And the Jaguars held a press conference to explain the situation to the press for the first time. And Blackmon appeared contrite. Mularkey and Smith were very critical of their top pick. And we'll have to wait and see how this unfolds.
Well, and just to clarify a little bit, this is his second arrest for DUI. However, the first time the charge was eventually lowered to an underage possession of alcohol, he got a break, and that's one of the reasons a lot of people are assuming he won't get a break this time. We welcome in senior editor Nolan Naraki, who, of course, is also our lead talent evaluator and the author of our Pro Football Weekly draft preview book. And Nolan, you know, the kid is he's a great talent, but I stopped short of calling him a unique or a rare talent, and now we wonder about the off-the-field stuff. So what does all this tell you about what's happened with this kid in the last couple months?
Well, there were definitely issues there in college, and anybody who really dug and did their homework was concerned that there was a chance he was not going to be able to stay out of trouble. The maturity issues, the partying issues, they were there, and the Jaguars took a chance. They have a terrible history of selecting receivers in the first round. We've seen Matt Jones, we've seen Reggie Williams and R.J. Soward all strike out in the NFL, and it's starting to look like this may be more of the same.
Well, how much, Nolan, do you think the Jaguars knew? I mean, like you said, they had to do their homework to find this out, and if they did, they would have understood what was going on with this kid. But do you think they knew enough, or were they willing to just sort of look beside these things and say, you know what, we love the talent, we're not too worried about it, or we think we can straighten him out? I mean, what do you think the approach was when they took to drafting him?
I think they were so desperate to add a receiving talent that they clearly traded up. They were willing to trade up, and they felt like they needed a number one receiver. They believed he was the number one receiver in the draft. I know teams that didn't think he was the fifth best. So, you know, it's all a part of perspective, and, you know, teams see things differently. I think there is going to be a little bit of a learning curve for him. There was at Oklahoma State. I don't know that he's going to make quite the immediate impact that they're expecting. I don't know if he's going to work the way that they want him to, but hopefully this will be a wake-up call for him.
Now, let's talk about another rookie, the young quarterback in Cleveland, Brandon Weeden, taken with the 22nd pick. And, you know, I think the Browns have gone out of their way to create a quarterback controversy. They're not hiding from it. They say it's a clear competition between him and third-year player Colt McCoy. And yet now it's beginning to appear that there may not be much competition, as in OTAs you've got Weeden running with the first team and then McCoy with the second team. Now, McCoy has also gotten snaps with the first team, but it seems like when they begin practice in the first round of reps, it's always Weeden, and it almost seems like it's a foregone conclusion that this open competition is going to be won by Weeden.
I don't think they would have drafted him in the first round had they not had the expectation that he was going to walk into the starting lineup and make an immediate contribution. When Colt McCoy was selected in the third round, there were a lot of concerns about whether he was going to be able to stay healthy. He was regarded as damaged goods, and he's got a frail body. He's got small hands. He doesn't have quite the stature that you want in that conference, where you got big quarterbacks like Joe Flacco and Ben Roethlisberger that have been very successful. So I think they're looking at Weeden and hoping that he has the stature, the strong arm, that he's going to be able to walk into that offense right away and get the job done. The big concern that I have with him, teams that really dug and did their homework, you know, there were some concerns about tendonitis in his throwing arm, that his elbow, you know, couldn't hold up. They had to sit him out of some practices at Oklahoma State. So we'll see if he can survive a 16-game season. We'll see if he can survive the pressure that Dick LeBeau is going to bring with the zone blitz pressure packages that, you know, he couldn't handle very well in college.
Well, it's apples and oranges, but we were talking about the Jaguars a second ago, and you know, they had the whole situation with Blaine Gabbert last year. Probably rush him into the lineup. I mean, Arthur, I'm kind of interested in hearing your take. You know, we hear about the damage that's potentially done for a young quarterback, and, you know, I know this kid's 29 with Whedon, but do they think that in Jacksonville they did so much negative stuff to Gabbert by throwing him early that it really set him back all that much? Or is the thinking now that he actually learned from the experience that maybe, you know, Whedon can go through some growing pains in Cleveland and have a positive effect?
Just hitting on Gabbert, I think that the line of thinking is that he's got a clean slate at this point. He's obviously got the brand new coaching staff, so I think they're going to try and just start fresh. Some of the things that maybe they didn't like the way he was being coached up last year, they're going to have a new opportunity with some guys who've done some good things in this league with young quarterbacks. So what we're hearing early on, and granted all these guys look real good in shorts and, you know, no pads, but we're hearing that more so off the field, Gabbert is really, you know, seems more confident, and he really has, you know, doesn't seem to be affected by the struggles that he had last year. So he's going to have better receivers around him. We've been hearing a lot about, well, they hope you're going to have a lot of better receivers around him. We don't know what's going to happen with Blackman, but I don't think they're too worried, as you mentioned, that he's going to be damaged goods. I think that it's more a clean slate approach.
Well, and Nolan, what's interesting to me is that Whedon actually has less college football experience than Gabbert had, and less specialized coaching at the position. But he's 8 years older, and some are really 6-7 years older, and a lot of folks saw that as a negative. Apparently the Cleveland Browns see that as a significant positive, just assuming that maturity will make up for lack of repetition.
Yeah, when you really break down the rookie weight scale, I think that is the reason that teams felt very comfortable selecting quarterbacks much earlier than they graded out on tape. To me, Whedon was a third-round talent. I know many teams had him in that range. That's really where you'd like to get a player like that. But when you look at how minimal you have to pay a quarterback, you know, he's essentially making backup money. So it was worth the gamble for where they took him.
Let me ask you quickly about one more kid, Nolan. I'm hearing Bruce Irvin buzz all over the NFL. I was stunned that the Seahawks took him as high as 15. I thought it was way too high for a one-dimensional player. Now everybody's saying in Pete Carroll's system he's going to be the defensive rookie of the year. What do you think?
He definitely has the skill set and elite edge rush capability to step into that offense and that elephant end position that Pete Carroll you know, really needs to make that defense work. You know, if he could stay out of trouble, and you know, from everybody that sat down with him and met with him, they felt like he was a good kid. He wasn't you know, quite what he was made out to be in terms of character. So I think if they can control him and put him in the right position to be successful, there's a chance he could have a Alden Smith type of year in terms of his production.
That's Nolan Naraki, our senior editor and lead talent evaluator, as well as the author of the Pro Football Weekly Draft Preview book. Associate editor Arthur Arkus will be back in a moment along with Kevin Fishbane as The Way We Hear It rolls on. You've got Pro Football Weekly on your radio dial. I'm Hub Arkus along with Eric Edholm, and we continue to visit with PFW Associate Editor Arthur Arkus, and also welcome in PFW Associate Editor Kevin Fishbane as we go around the NFL during this off-season OTA part of the NFL year. And Arthur, I want to come back to you on another one of your ball clubs, the Tennessee Titans. I think surprised a lot of people at 9-7 last year and Mike Munchak's rookie year as a head coach. Matter of fact, they're a playoff team. They lost a tiebreaker. It could have been quite a year. It was an interesting year with Jake Locker, who they drafted to sit and learn from Matt Hasselbeck. But as Hasselbeck got dinged up, Locker got in the lineup a little bit and was pretty productive. I think he had pretty much, you know, almost 100 quarterback rating over a stretch of games. And so as they go into or through this offseason, does Locker have a chance of claiming that job this year, or does Hasselbeck still look like he's got 1 year left in him?
Yeah, I think Locker, the youngster, absolutely has a chance. They're calling it an open competition. They're going to be splitting reps throughout the summer. So the best man is going to win the job. We've been hearing all along that the best man is likely, at least initially, still to be Hasselbeck. If you look at what he had to overcome last year in terms of, you know, Chris Johnson being such a huge disappointment and Kenny Britt going down early. Hasselbeck actually held up quite well and put together one of his finest seasons. So I think they're happy with what they got there. Now, in Locker, there's no question the upside is very clear and was on full display in his limited opportunities last year. He showed that he could put points on the scoreboard quickly. He could get outside the pocket and make plays. He definitely gives the Tennessee offense a different element than it has with Matt Hasselbeck. So, as I mentioned, it's going to be an open competition. We're hearing that Hasselbeck is likely to get the job at least out of the gate because they've got a tough early schedule. There's some thinking that if they throw Locker in there against some pretty tough defenses and the Lions and the Texans, they've got the Patriots early as well. They may be better off going with the veteran who's a little bit better at, you know, reading blitzes and has a better idea and then go from there.
Oh, one guy who's probably got the starting job in Tennessee without much competition is Chris Johnson. And yet last season was such a strange one for him. I mean, really had, you know, I think 13 of his 16 games you could call severe disappointments, really didn't get it going, had a couple of big games that kind of skewed his numbers a little close to the video game type stuff we saw in his first couple of seasons. But he now says he's added muscle and he's gotten a little stronger this offseason, working hard. There's always been questions about his focus and concentration, whether he would be one of these flash-in-the-pan kind of guys early in his career and then burn out. You know, what's the take on him? What is the feeling? Is this added muscle going to help him? It's hurt other backs, slowed guys down. I mean, what's the thinking on his new frame?
Well, I think it definitely has a chance to help. I think the bigger problem with CJ last year is that really if the hole wasn't there, he just kind of gave up. At least that's what it looked like to observers, is that he really didn't have that same fight trying to get through the hole and sort of create his own yards. And let's not be mistaken, he's not that type of back, but he was going to need to help out the offensive line a little bit more, which wasn't very good in run blocking last year. So I think that certainly, it's a fresh approach for him as well. I think the really good news is that he's with the club this offseason. He normally works out on his own in Orlando. So I think being with the team has definitely been an added benefit. And perhaps more than anything, I think just not having the lockout, not having that lengthy contract holdout, he's going to be in better shape. That's what you heard from people close to the situation, is that it took him almost half the season to get in shape. You mentioned those couple big games. They did come later in the year. They did come against pretty bad defenses, but still, it was once he got good, he got going, and they're hoping they're going to see that for 16 games this season.
Kevin Fishbane covers the AFC East for us. And, Kevin, you know, the Jets, all the buzz, of course, about Sanchez and of course, the quarterback battle that they've got going with Tim Tebow, or lack of a battle, as the case may be, and Sanchez West. There may be a bigger story brewing in New York that not a lot of people are focused on. Is Darrelle Revis an unhappy camper?
You know, he's been very wishy-washy with reporters. He has not wanted to talk about the contract at all. When they bring it up, he just kind of shakes his head. But he also will not confirm he'll be at training camp. So we might have another Revis holdout like we saw, and really like the entire country saw 2 years ago, because it was pretty much featured on Hard Knocks. You know, Revis, when he got that new contract in 2010, it was pretty front-loaded. The way, you know, he got a lot of money those first couple years. This year it looks like he's set to get around $7.5 million. A fair amount of money, but for the number one corner in the entire NFL, he's certainly worth a little more than that. And the word is, it looks like, Revis and his agents are trying to work up another new long-term contract. So it's kind of wait and see at this point if he reports to training camp. But this is certainly a distraction that the Jets want no part of.
Yeah, but how come these kids can't do the math? I mean, they get a total amount of dollars.
Yeah.
They may get it front-end loaded to benefit them, but it's spread over the deal. You got to honor the contract. We're going to talk more about this in just a minute. We're going to take a very quick commercial break, and then we'll continue with Kevin and Arthur right after we get these words in. Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Pro Football Weekly. And just before we went to the commercial break, we were visiting with Associate Editor Kevin Fishbane and talking about the New York Jets. And, you know, it frustrates me no end, Kevin, that these kids act like, and let's face it, Darrelle Revis may be the best cornerback in the NFL, but he's a kid in his mid to late 20s. When he got that deal a couple years ago, he became the highest paid cornerback in the NFL if you average the life of the contract. Now, the fact that this year he's not getting that much because he got so much more, you know, last year and the year before, I would think at some point it becomes a problem in the locker room and amongst his teammates.
Yeah, and that's a locker room that doesn't need any problems for sure. And you look at, and as you mentioned, he got the big total dollars, and that was a holdout that the Jets did not want to have to deal with. And they, you know, that went for a very long time. And on the the field, there were some, you know, issues afterwards because Revis had hamstring problems early on. You remember that Patriots game early in 2010? He went down. Kyle Wilson, again, to get thrust in the starting lineup as a rookie. The Jets really struggle without Revis. I mean, they need him on the field, and they need him fresh. And this cannot be a distraction. And, you know, the two sides are going to have to work something out. Just, you know, and maybe Revis is just going to have to, you know, swallow his pride and play this season and wait another year to get that long-term deal.
Let's swing back to associate editor Arthur Arkish. And Arthur, the Houston Texans, the best team in the AFC South last year. Some people think they could be the best team in the AFC this year, but for a team coming off its first division championship, they've made some pretty dramatic changes. D'Amico Ryans is gone, Mario Williams is gone, and surprisingly, on the offensive line, Eric Winston gone, a couple other spots to fill. How are they rebuilding that O-line?
Well, there's definitely going to be some competition for those jobs. They do, you know, the guys that are penciled in are guys that are holdovers from last year and Rashad Butler, and Antoine Caldwell. But with both of these guys who both do have starting experience, they've had a hard time staying on the field. So they're definitely going to be pushed by, a couple of young players. Derek Newton, who is a seventh round pick last year, is going to give heavy competition out at the right tackle position. And then Brandon Brooks, the rookie, who's a very different type of offensive lineman for the Texans, who are known for having the small athletic players. This guy's a monster, but they say he can move, and he's going to give Caldwell a run for his money.
You know, it didn't get a lot of headlines this offseason, but T.J. Yates was elevated to the backup position, essentially becoming the starter, going from third string to starter, winning the first franchise playoff game, and then obviously getting the backup job when Matt Leinart wasn't brought back. But, you know, Matt Schaub is heading into his final year of his deal. I mean, how much additional pressure do you think there is on him, considering everything that happened last year, considering his injury history, and considering that, you know, he may not be retained after this year?
I'd say there's quite a bit of pressure. I mean, you say first and foremost, he's coming off that Liz Frank injury, so he is not going to be a participant, hasn't been up until this point. He's hoping to be ready for camp, but they're going to be very cautious with him. So first and foremost, a guy who's not particularly mobile to begin with is going to have to prove that that foot is okay and that he can you know, withstand the rigors of a full season. But beyond that, they have not even opened the door on starting to talk contract extension. So clearly they want to wait and see how he does this season. Schaub has been very good when he's been on the field for them, but as we know, that's been a problem staying on the field. He's also had a bit of trouble. Sometimes he's been known to get the yips late in games. So, as you said, the rookie T.J. Yates kind of came out of nowhere, was able to lead them to a playoff victory. They haven't seen that yet with Matt Schaub. So there is absolutely a ton of pressure on him and on the entire organization that's expected to take the next step.
Kevin, the Buffalo Bills have been busy this offseason, and specifically, or let's even go back to last year in the 2011 draft when they used the third overall pick on Marcell Dareus, who looks like he's going to be all that and more. This year they add Mario Williams in free agency. Now they're getting Pro Bowl nose tackle Kyle Williams back from injury. He missed most of the year last year. Chris Kelce, who's a hell of an end in a 4-3, was out of position last year. Sean Merriman is healthy again. This D-line's starting to look pretty scary. That's a lot of pretty good names we just rattled off.
Yeah, when you see that Sean Merriman, I mean, obviously you can make jokes on end about his injury history, but when you see the fact that he's running with the twos and threes in practice at defensive end, that just shows you how much depth that they have, and that says a lot for a team that's run the 3-4 the past couple of years. So they do have guys like Tuan Edwards, Spencer Johnson, Alex Carrington. They're trying to kind of find a position for those guys. But you look at that front four, you got Mario Williams, Dareus, and Kyle Williams, and then Mark Anderson and Chris Kelce are in this, you know, in this battle right now to play end, and that's a great problem for Dave Lancet to have when you look at a guy in Kelce who's thrilled to be back at defensive end. He played a little bit of it in the nickel when they were in the 3-4. And Mark Anderson, who had a great year for the Patriots last season. Those two guys are in a position battle, again, for Lancet's aggressive defense and a team that needs to up the pass rush. And we saw what happened, or we've seen what's happened with the Giants and some of these teams, the Lions really bulking up the defensive line, getting pass rushers down there. That's what the Bills are doing, and they have to do it when they play the Patriots twice a year.
You know, guys, Dave Lancet's gotten mixed reviews as a head coach in Chicago, in Miami, in the NFL, University of Pittsburgh, but nobody disputes what this guy can do as a defensive coordinator with a 4-3 defense. And the Buffalo Bills are a pretty interesting team to keep an eye on right now. We're going to take another quick commercial break, and then the NFL talk rolls on in just a moment or two. Yes, it is, and I am Hub Arkish in studio with my co-host today, senior editor Eric Edholm, and on the PFW hotline, we have associate editor Arthur Arkish, and he is now joined by senior editor Mike Wilkiningen. Guys, a little roundtable conversation here. I'm curious to get everybody's opinion because there's another farce being played out in the National Football League, and forgive me for labeling it, so obviously you know where I stand on it. I'm curious what everybody else thinks. Reports are out there now that on June 18th, which depending on when you're listening to this radio show is a week to 10 days from now, Roger Goodell, the commissioner, will hear the appeals of the four players who were suspended in the New Orleans Saints bounty program. Those players, of course, being Jonathan Vilma and Will Smith and Anthony Hargrove and Scott Fujita. And I have a question that I guess I don't understand it. There's a reason in the trial portion of our government or whatever you want to call it, the legal system, that there are trial courts and then appellate courts. When you are found guilty by one judge and you appeal, you don't go back to the judge who sentenced you. And yet in this case, Roger Goodell has issued these sentences, and now apparently he's going to hear the appeal. At least one of these players whose appeal he's hearing is also suing him personally, and that's Jonathan Vilma. So, Eric, somebody's got to explain it to me. This makes no sense.
And this was one of the things that I think the union really rallied against during the whole lockout and trying to get a new CBA. They said, you know, our players don't understand how this is possible, and they had every right to question it, and yet we're still with the same kind of system in this new thing. And so you can chalk this up, in my opinion, as yet another item that the union lost in the CBA battle, that they're still having to go through this process where Roger Goodell is going to hear these appeals, probably isn't going to change his mind. He always talks about new information. As far as I know, there isn't new information except this bulldog lawyer for Vilma who's just trying to, you know, shoot as many guns as he can.
Well, and Wilkie, Eric just touched on it. Mike Wilkening, senior editor, is joining us. The players can complain about this system all they want, which is clearly not fair and not part of any due process, and yet they agreed to it. And so I can be as outraged as I want. This, to me, is a failure of the players' leadership in their union that put them in this situation in the first place.
The system in place is the system in place at this point, and with the CBA not to be reopened for, you know, I believe 9 years at this point, this is the reality of the situation, that players that run afoul of whatever league policies they run afoul of, and if they appeal to the league, are going to have to go through this process and, you know, sort of hope for the Hail Mary sort of approach, that either new information comes to light, you can make a case of some sort. But yeah, I mean, this obviously looks like an uphill battle for the four players in question here.
Well, and Arthur, I love Eric mentioned Vilma's bulldog lawyer, and I'm sure he's all that and more. And of course, that's how DeMarie Smith would probably portray himself as well, the executive director of the NFLPA. And yet they're going to appeal to a man who they have filed a lawsuit against for defamation of character. I mean, how does Roger Goodell claim in any way that he can give a fair appeal and hearing to Jonathan Vilma?
I don't know how he can, but I think that bulldog lawyer is going to have to be pretty darn good, because in my eyes, this is really a formality at this point. I just, you know, I'm in agreement with all you guys that it's really ludicrous. You kind of want to feel for the players, but at the same time, they kind of have to, sleep in the bed, so to speak, that they've made at this point. So, it's a weird situation, and we know Goodell's got an iron fist. We didn't know he ruled with that iron fist on every single instance like he does here.
And yet Michael Ginsburg, the guy who's representing Jonathan Vilma in this case, has been something of a successful litigator when it comes to the NFL. He was representing the Williams, the Pat Williams and Kevin Williams in the Star Caps case, a thing that dragged out for 2 years, and they actually got their suspensions reduced. So who knows? I mean, maybe this guy has some firepower we don't know about here.
Well, but Eric, this is where it gets interesting, and this is why I have been so outraged for almost a year now at how I feel the Players Association failed their players and got clobbered in this CBA,
yeah,
is that Ginsburg has been successful in a court with due process.
Yeah, right.
And yet, you know, Dean Smith is screaming about these are unfair because there's no due process. We haven't seen all the evidence. Well, you agreed to a system where you're not necessarily entitled to see all the evidence. And so this is the part that makes it all so frustrating. So let me give you guys each maybe 20, 30 seconds to comment on something else that the NFLPA and the league were involved in this week. And they apparently agreed on this one. D. Smith filed a grievance claiming the Seattle Seahawks had violated the spirit of the CBA with contact in an OTA that was not allowed. NFL Management Council has agreed. They have penalized the Seattle Seahawks 2 OTAs and 1 workout session. Those are 3 practice days that everybody else is going to have that they're not allowed to have. Wilkie, I'll start with you. What does that mean?
Well, in the culture of the league right now with regards to OTAs, that is one thing where I think the players have made some gains in the sense that, look, there's only so much hitting you can do during the season. Now, practices, obviously, that the schedule's a little bit different. I think when it comes down to it, you've got the league and the union maybe somewhat on the same page here with regards to legislating as much contact as you can out of the practice portions of the game. So any violations of that certainly, I think, are going to be looked upon as serious, with player safety being such an issue at the forefront for the league right now.
Arthur, Pete Carroll continues to stand out amongst coaches as, I guess, wild man is something I can kindly call him. I've got a quote here from Carroll. Quote, "We've had great practices. Our guys have met every expectation. They have worked like crazy," Carroll said. Quote, "We have talked all the talk throughout the time about taking care of one another, working to make it safe, playing within the guidelines, and we probably have stretched this limit, obviously, by this indication," close quote. Yeah, pretty obvious, Pete. You just got a couple practices taken away from you. I mean, at what point, Arthur, does Carroll risk the players starting to tune him out as he continues to be a coach who gets out over the edge more than most?
Yeah, it's definitely a fine line, and I mean, I think we know that he is a player's coach and certainly, you know, demands respect and gets it in that locker room, but you do have to be careful, and this would be one of those instances. I don't want to make it sound like losing a couple OTAs is the end of the world, so to speak, but, you know, you wonder how the players do view something like this. I mean, frankly, they're probably not too disappointed because it's two less OTAs they have to partake in, but it's a slippery slope, and I think they have to be very careful, and I wouldn't be shocked. Like you said, Carroll's been a bit of a madman, a bit of a rogue guy, but I wouldn't be completely shocked to see more teams kind of fall prey to this. I think that in this type of league, everyone is trying to get whatever edge they can, and it's a good, you know, I don't know if other teams are getting away with it or if we're going to see more of this in the future.
Arthur, it's a great point, because the irony of all this is I'm not sure the Seahawks players care all that much. This is the NFLPA trying to focus on the points that they think they gained in the CBA, and in this case they got the management council to agree with them. We'll talk a little bit more about this after we take a very quick commercial break right here on Pro Football League. Welcome back to Pro Football Weekly. Again, we thank all of you for being with us each week as we continue to get you your NFL fix during the offseason. There's always plenty going on. We were just talking about some of the latest grievances between the NFLPA and the Management Council of the Owners. It seems like the 10-year collective bargaining agreement that was supposed to create peace amongst players and owners is now going to be a bickering point, at least early on. All they want to do is fight. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in the publisher's pen. But I want to move on to some of the on-the-field type news. And, Wilkie, you've got the AFC North beat. You've got the Baltimore Ravens. Never short of stories there. And Terrell Suggs' blown Achilles continues to be a story. It seems pretty obvious at this point, even though he initially stated he did it working out because he wants to make sure he gets paid and, you know, he was doing what he was supposed to. He did it playing basketball. I don't think anybody's disputing that at this point. Everybody knows Terrell Suggs loves playing basketball. But playing basketball is a workout. And so is this really all kind of a tempest in a teapot, particularly with those who are claiming that the Ravens want to try and avoid paying him by saying it was a non-football injury?
It's only an issue if the Ravens want to make it an issue, and there really isn't any indication at this point that the Ravens want to make it an issue. I think Terrell Suggs, clearly one of their key defensive players, a leader. If you go and say, okay, this was a non-football injury, which you can via the CBA, if you want to investigate and look all those things, yeah, you could do that if you were the Ravens. But again, at what cost? Because, you know, you could go and try to do that, but, you know, it would send probably a message in the locker room that might not be the most positive one. This is a team with championship aspirations. I think, you know, John Harbaugh said it. I mean, you know, pretty much indicated the focus is getting Terrell Suggs back. Now, how much he can contribute this year is another issue altogether. But look, we're talking about a guy that clearly has been in shape the last couple of years. And however you get hurt in the offseason, you know, it is what it is. He's hurt. That's the material thing to the Ravens. They've lost one of their best defensive players. Replacing him has to be the issue at this point.
Well, and Eric, I think Wilkie just touched on the salient point here. If there is more of a player's coach in the NFL than John Harbaugh, he's going to be hard to find. Quote, player's coach, whatever we call that. And Harbaugh has come out and say, I don't care if he was playing basketball or not. I mean, this guy is the reigning NFL defensive MVP. Yeah. At some point, you want him back. Are you going to create a problem by trying not to pay him to save? And yes, it's a lot of money, but I mean, what kind of message are you sending in your locker room if you try and fight this
thing? Yeah, and you can maybe question Jim Harbaugh's candor when he talked about Peyton Manning and whether he was interested in the quarterback. His brother, in this case, I believe him. I really don't think he cares because he knows that Terrell Suggs is a feisty guy who's going to probably be back sooner than anyone expects, probably be back, you know, ahead of the curve of the normal rehab. And like you said, he's one of the leaders in the locker room, and they're, in theory, so close to a title. Why mess with stuff? This is not Bill Belichick willing to swim upstream and you know, call out his veterans when he has to. This is a coach who I think has his team in lockstep, and he's not going to rock the boat too much.
Well, and guys, John's brother Jimmy is a good buddy of mine. I'm tired of people picking on him. What I can tell you for sure is Jim believes what he's saying.
And yeah, that's true.
That's really all that matters, you know. So we're going to stay away from the 49ers this week. But, Wilkie, another one of your clubs, the Pittsburgh Steelers. I think everybody is watching with fascination to see how the relationship between the, shall we call him, somewhat volatile Todd Haley, the new offensive coordinator, and Ben Roethlisberger is going to work itself out. And early returns, according to Haley, is that all is sweetness and light.
Well, I think that everybody's going to keep an eye on this. And, yeah, Haley talking to the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette pretty much saying that, look, that, you know, with regards to any, you know, sort of thoughts or concerns that Roethlisberger might have about this offense, that he hasn't seen that. And, you know, I think the real litmus test, guys, is going to come down to when they're in the first tough situation during the regular season and how they react. If there's any sort of on-field or off-field fireworks that sort of come out here. You know, look, Ben Roethlisberger's won a couple titles. I think Todd Haley certainly wants to get to that level. You know, you have to think that it behooves everybody to make this work. And at the end of the day, you know, certainly this is going to be an offense that's going to rise and fall with Ben Roethlisberger at the controls with that passing game, particularly with Rashard Mendenhall, you know, coming off the knee injury. The passing game is going to make this work, and Roethlisberger's the key to that.
All right, guys, we've got to pay a few more bills here. We will let all of our great sponsors have a moment or two to let our listeners know what they've got to offer, and then we're back as we offer more NFL talk right here on Pro Football Weekly. Welcome back to Pro Football Weekly. Again, thank you all so much for listening. We love having you with us every week. And right now I want to stay in studio with my co-host and our senior editor, Eric Edholm, who covers the NFC East amongst other clubs. And the Philadelphia Eagles, last year they had this boisterous offseason with all kinds of change. And, of course, it was a big disappointment as they finished 8-8. This year they're having this ridiculously quiet offseason with all kinds of change, and they're hoping that it'll work out differently. And the big news this week is that Joe Banner, he's not out. He is going from being team president to a senior advisor to the owner, Jeffrey Lurie, but with a clear path towards leaving the ball club, as he and Lurie have both talked about his desire to take on another organization. Don Smolenski, the longtime COO of the club, steps into the president's role. But the real result of this is that Andy Reid and Howie Roseman, the GM, are pretty much clearly in charge right now, and there is nowhere else to point a finger if things don't go better this year.
Yeah, that's the interesting part about this whole thing, is that Andy Reid now gets the power he's been seeking for a while. We've heard this for a while. You know, Andy Reid probably has more personnel control than 90% of the head coaches out there, but he wanted even more. He wanted final say on almost all matters. And so, you know, that kind of minimizes, I think, the GM's role a certain amount. And I think it certainly pushed Banner out the door. His minimizing effect on this team was felt over the past year or so. This is a move that some people said has been in the works for over a year. So, you know, the fact that Lurie and Banner are no longer together is shocking. It's been so long, 17 years, childhood friends, and yet Reid has won this power struggle, but with a huge caveat. He's got to produce, or he's not going to be the head coach for very long, I think.
Arthur, in the AFC South last year, you watched one of the greatest GMs of all time, Bill Polian, have one of the most successful marriages in the league break up between him and of course, Jim Irsay. You've got right now people watching Gene Smith with his new owner, Shad Khan. These relationships can be so fragile, and how much extra pressure does it put on these coaches and let's call personnel-type GMs when suddenly it's clear that they have all of the power in their laps?
Well, I think it brings quite a bit of extra pressure. There's no question. And I think, you know, Eric hit on it. This is something that Andy Reid has been wanting for a long time, and now he's got it, and he's just going to have a lot more responsibility on his plate. He's a guy who in that city in Philadelphia obviously has, you know, tons of pressure on him all the time. So I think it's just kind of compounds that situation. And as you mentioned, we saw with Bill Polian last year, no matter, you know, they had 13 years of greatness, but it was one year where things really fell apart, and certainly some of the beyond personnel issues, some of the, you know, the power hungry and inability to get along with some of his colleagues, you know, played a part in that. I don't know as much about that with Andy Reid's situation, but I think it is definitely all relative.
Well, it's so interesting to look at the different structures that there are around the NFL. There are some head coaches who have no personnel head control. You've got a guy like John Fox out in Denver and same in Carolina before. He never wanted the personnel control. He just wanted to coach the football team and let his GM know, okay, this is what I need and this is what you've got to go get me. So, I mean, it is fascinating to look at the different ways that, that teams structure these things.
Well, and Wilkie, it's interesting to me. You've got two of the best front offices in football with Kevin Colbert in Pittsburgh and Ozzie Newsome in Baltimore as GMs who have complete personnel control. It doesn't seem to bother John Harbaugh and Mike Tomlin. You've also got what may be the most dysfunctional front office in the league in Cincinnati, and then we're all trying to figure out what's going on in Cleveland. So there's no clear model here that every NFL team chooses to follow.
Right, and at the end of the day, the product on the field is what matters. And when you look at the Philadelphia Eagles, they look loaded this year. They look even stronger, I think, than they did a season ago. Clearly, I think their weaknesses caught up with them. But, Eric, when I look at this roster, they've strengthened the linebacking core. They've had a full off season now. You know, this might be a situation where, yeah, Andy Reid might want more personnel power, and this is a make-or-break season, but I think they're in a better position to be in this sort of make-or-break year than they were certainly in 2011.
Yeah, more time. You know, more time to develop. I think that's the biggest thing, and Reid feels like if he gets the players he wants, he's going to have this run at a title that's really escaped him except for one Super Bowl appearance.
Well, and it's interesting. Guys, clearly that model can work as it does for Bill Belichick in New England. It happens every once in a while. But who are the great young teams around the league now? San Francisco with the marriage between Balky and Harbaugh, and we just talked about Pittsburgh and Baltimore. Strong GM personnel, strong coaching, separate but divide, you know, or rather divided but equal. It seems to be the most consistently successful formula in the league. We're going to take another quick commercial break here, but don't run away. We've got a little more for you in the Publisher's Pen, and it's coming up right after this.
And now with the Publisher's Pen, the publisher and editor of Pro Football Weekly, Hub Arkish.
Eric, thank you very much. You know, I mentioned this during the course of the program. One of the things that we're seeing this offseason is the National Football League Players Association, led by its executive director, DeMarie Smith, pretty much complaining about almost everything that is happening in the NFL these days. Now, the two sides, management and players, did work out an agreement to get the Pro Bowl one more year. But beyond that, NFL has now locked out its officials for the coming season. Hopefully they'll get that settled before the start of the season. DeMarie Smith has already started calling it dealing with scabs, been very critical, says that the PA should have a voice in that. Unfortunately for him, according to his CBA, no, they don't have a voice in that. And that's really the thrust of what I want to talk about here. Everything that's happening now, the complaints about the bounty program and the suspensions, the PA gave up their right to have this CBA, you know, eradicated in court. The bottom line is that for 20-some years, they had judicial oversight of their collective bargaining agreement. One of the main things that the owners wanted to make go away was that judicial oversight, and the players gave it up. I think when you look at the financial ramifications of the new CBA, it now is looking like the players did not get the deal that D. Smith was telling them they got, at least short money in the first 3 or 4 years of the deal. So everywhere you look, we now have a players association with nothing to do for the next 9 years, going to try and make an argument about everything. It's not a big deal yet, but this could get very old very fast for fans if it continues. That's going to do it for this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly. Our thanks to Randy Meyer, our producer and engineer, and, of course, Syndication Networks, our home studio and syndicator. And most of all, our thanks to all of you for listening. Catch you next week, same time, same station, on Pro Football Weekly.